Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason. This podcast was made for stories like this. This story with Jerome Rand is one of my all-time favorites. It is pure, epic, amazing adventure. And Jerome is such a humble person, such a likable personality. I can't believe he's the type of person that can be alone this long. He seems just so personable. But we're going to hear his story about how he sailed around the world by himself. He left from Gloucester, Massachusetts in October 2017, and 271 days later, he arrived back in Gloucester and covering almost 30,000 miles. Only a handful of people ever have done a solo, nonstop sail around the world. And Jerome is now doing it again. We interviewed him last year about his trips during COVID that did not go to plan, some of the crazy things that happened. He tried to do a solo sail around the world from pole to pole to pole, so kind of perpendicular than going around the equator, which you can't go around the equator, the land's in the way, but you know, south of all the continents. Unbelievable adventure, but fog and ice and just COVID threw a wrench in the plans because some countries wouldn't allow him to enter their water because there would be no search and rescue available if something happened. So they didn't want to take on that liability. But anyway, he's out on a trip again. The best place to follow him looks like TikTok. He looks like he updates there a lot more than anything else. And Jerome, can't wait to have you back on. This is one of the coolest talks I've ever had. And the other two episodes, which I will link in the show notes, we broke it into two parts, and it was an in-person interview, so we spent like 3 hours talking. Definitely worth a listen. Crazy stories. Jerome is a Hall of Fame Adventure Sports Podcast guest. So without further ado, let's jump into this epic story. All right, folks, welcome to today's episode. We got a great episode, and in fact, there's a lot that I don't know about his story, so I'm pretty excited to learn, pretty excited to just kind of be right here alongside with you, listeners, and learning about Jerome Rand's story. So, Jerome, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you very much, Mason. It's an honor to be here. You know, like we were saying just a few minutes ago, I'm preparing the boat right now to sail from South Carolina up to Maine. And before I go, one of the things I always do is sort of scope different podcasts. And I sort of randomly came across this one. It's probably a couple weeks ago, but I've been listening ever since. And I'm on here with some pretty heavy hitters, that's for sure. It's really, really enjoyable.
Hey man, you're right up there with him, dude. This is, to me, this, what you're doing is just, it's equivalent to people climbing Everest or some of the even the lesser known huge mountains. It's just so out of my experience that it's terrifying, but it's also really intriguing. And you were mentioning before too, like it's a fleeting thought of everyone that gets in a boat or sails that to go around the world, but you know, you're doing it. It's you're right up there with him, man. So I appreciate you though saying that. It's we work hard to make this show happen. But so you mentioned going from South Carolina to Maine. Is that where you are right now? You're in South Carolina.
Yep, I'm sitting on the boat as we speak at a little tiny marina just outside of Beaufort, South Carolina.
And, oh man,
yeah. At the end of this month, I'll be headed right up there back up to Rockland, Maine. So I head offshore, usually takes about 10 days or so. And I may actually be taking a crew member with me this time. And that'd be the first since, 3 years or so that I have not done a sailing trip solo.
Holy cow, man. And I hate to immediately tell a story, but the only memory I have about Beaufort, I was there one time. I was actually on a bike tour going up the East Coast from Florida to Maine, and I met a doctor riding kind of his nightly circuit around Beaufort. And
yeah,
and he we just got to talking, and we stopped at a gas station to like get some Gatorade, and he goes, "Hey man, I'd love to have you over for dinner. My wife and I would love to have you over." He goes, "She's not home right now, but here's my address and here's my keys to my house. Go hang out at my house. My dogs are outside. They're totally cool." He goes, "Go just grab a beer and chill on the couch till I get home." And I pull up to this beautiful mansion on the Intercoastal Waterway, and
get the key and just open his front door and have a seat. And it was, and he came home like 30 minutes later. It was the weirdest but coolest experience. And we had a great time. But that's the only really thought that comes to mind about that area. But it seems to be a lot of nice people.
That Southern hospitality, man, it's nothing compares to it. You know, I always felt that when I was doing the Appalachian Trail. I mean, geez, you could get rides. Everybody was helping. So many people had food. And, you know, it sort of seemed, and I'm from the north, but it sort of seemed the further north you got, the less that was happening. So I love the South.
That's awesome. Yeah, that area is so gorgeous. Gosh. So, man, I you know, I kind of want to go all the way back. Like, you know, you say you grew up in the, or you were from the north. Did you grow up in the north? Did you grow up doing things like this? And if not, like, what happened in your life to make you, you know, first do the Appalachian Trail than this? Did it start off slow, or was it just a kind of all at once thing?
You know, I remember, you know, as a kid, you know, I was sort of the one who was less apt to go and join, you know, the soccer team or any of that stuff. I was the one who was, you know, walking around in the forest or more than anything, being from Michigan, I was on the lake shore, you know, pulling stones over and looking for crayfish and all that sort of stuff. So I think I've always had sort of an affinity or a curiosity with Mother Nature and what's going on. And I think I've always sort of held that. As far as sort of getting out there and really immersing myself in it, I have to say that most of my inspirations really come from books that I've read. You know, the Appalachian Trail, once I read A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson, like that was mm-hmm. it. I knew I had to do it. And then, you know, as I got into my sort of sailing career in my 20s, that was when, you know, I started, you know, every boat that I got on, because we used to sail, deliver people's yachts from one place to another, but every boat had about four or five of the same books. And there were all these old books back, you know, they were written in the 60s and 70s about these guys attempting to take a boat around the world without stopping. And, you know, it's only been about 50 years or so since the first one was actually completed. And I don't know. I mean, you know, these are titles like Godforsaken Sea, and, you know, obviously The Perfect Storm, things like that, those sort of titles. But for some reason, they just, I was so curious. I wanted to know and I wanted to experience what these guys were experiencing out in that wild, wild ocean.
Wow, that's actually really cool to hear it was books, because, you know, I don't know, it wasn't, you know what I mean? Like, that's so accessible to so many people. You can just order a book somewhere or find it at a library, and that can change your life.
Well, and, it, you know, it was kind of interesting because, you know, previous to reading, I think it was Godforsaken Sea was, or Voyage for Mad Men. That was the one I think that really hooked me in. And that was about the first race that they tried to do this. But previous to that, I was totally oblivious to anything, you know, about sailing all the way around the world. It was, you know, it was just something I didn't know. And, you know, I think in sort of the adventure world, you know, you mentioned the name Mount Everest, and everybody knows exactly what that is. And I still, you know, to this day, when I'm, you know, doing presentations and things, there's a lot of people that come up to me afterwards and say, I had no idea. No idea people even do what you just did. And it's, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, it is. It's a little known adventure, but it's also one of the craziest ones you can do.
I'm not going to lie. Personally, I love those types of things where you realize maybe there might not be even a book about it yet, or there might not be a real, you know, way to do it. I definitely, maybe because once I start getting into the bigger adventures, I'm kind of towards the bottom of the list as far as like ability and like impressiveness.
Hey.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like something like this sounds awesome.
Well, I tell you, I mean, that listening to some of the stuff of your old trips from going from Alaska down, do you go all the way down to the Florida Keys?
No, I just went home, which was Central Florida. Now that I think about it, I wish I would have gone all the way down, but going home was cool too.
That's pretty ridiculous. I'm not going to lie.
Man, what are you talking about? I'm on ground the whole time. You know what I'm saying?
Like, I know.
I can
there's
get
so
off
many.
And walk. You're in the middle of, literally in the middle of nowhere. Like, you want to talk about wilderness? I think it often gets overlooked how how much water is wilderness. You feel like, oh, I'm out in the woods, I'm so alone. You're really never that far from other people anywhere on land, unless you're in the middle of the Sahara or something, or northern
true.
Canada. But in the ocean, man, you had to have been so far from people. I mean, that's wild to me.
I think for during some times in the Pacific and such, you know, the closest human beings to me were probably on the space station when they would pass overhead, because I think the space station is like 200 miles up or something. And I'd be, you know, when you get into the middle of the Pacific, there's it's called Point Nemo, and I think you're 1600 miles away from the nearest point of land. And that's the biggest open expanse on the planet.
That is a wild perspective. That thought has never crossed my mind. That is nuts, but that would be true.
And you see them. You see them all the time down there, because once you get way deep into the southern hemisphere, there's no more airplanes because none of the routes fly down there. Mm. So the only thing you ever really see are satellites, and the space station is, you know, it's as bright as Venus. And so you see it every time it passes over.
That is incredible, man. I can't imagine the feeling. It has to be similar to the feeling of being in space in a lot of ways, knowing there's no human near you anywhere within, you know, potentially thousands of miles. That's crazy. I've never felt that. But so you know, to go back to, you know, you were an adventurous kid. You read these books. You read that one by Bill. Is it Bill Bryce? I know I can picture the cover. With the bear.
A Walk in the Woods.
Walk in the Woods, exactly. And so you read that, and you were immediately like, I got to go do the AT, or how did that work? And what was that process like for wherever stage in life you were?
Well, so at that point, I was living and working down in the Caribbean at a place called the Bitter End Yacht Club on Virgin Gorda. So that's in the British Virgin Islands. I was running their water sports department, you know, pretty much one of the best jobs you can have, you know, almost kind of like being the king of the beach bums down there. But it's also very intense. You know, there are a lot of times where it's 16-hour days, and then, you know, wake up in the middle of the night to go rescue somebody on a boat sort of stuff. And after 5 years, I just needed a break. I was so burnt out. I was absolutely cooked. And, you know, I had been thinking about the Appalachian Trail for a while. And I used to have it on audiobook, and I would listen to it, you know, when I was falling asleep. And finally, I just said, okay, this is going to be the year. And it was 2012 when I finally flew up to Michigan, did a little training for a month, and got used to being in the cold. So I'm up way up in northern Michigan, and, you know, got to acclimatize because, you know, early on, I think I started March 2nd for the trail. And so I was, you know, expecting to be in snow, you know, in the Smokies and all that sort of stuff. And so I acclimatized, and then I head on down, and I set off. And it was just, it was sort of just a break. I don't want to say I felt like I was in the rat race, but I definitely felt like there was something missing in my life. And a nice long walk in the woods, a little bit of adventure, was definitely in need.
Did it fulfill that need that you had?
I took to the trail like a bee to honey. I mean, it was awesome. I was camping, you know, pretty much alone most nights. I went and, you know, I would get into camp, I'd make a little bonfire, you know, I'd cook my dinner, I'd read books. You know, normally I didn't even go to sleep until maybe 11 o'clock at night. And I'd wake up, and I was probably one of the happier people walking that year. And it was actually kind of funny, because as I got further and further north up into Maine, I started to see the Southbounders. And, you know, that year, the early part of the year was warm and dry, but the tail end was really rainy. And I would walk into these huts, and these Southbounders, who had only been on the trail for a week or two, looked absolutely miserable. I mean, on the edge of just abandoning everything. And I'd sort of come bouncing in, like happy to be all wet and just, you know, trying to live my last few weeks on the trail to the fullest. And, you know, I remember giving a lot of pep talks towards the end, and being like, it's going to get better. Don't worry. It's going to get better. But, you know, I just loved it. I tried to suck up every second of it. And once I finished that, I knew at that point immediately that it was time to move on to a bigger thing. But, you know, when you finish the Appalachian Trail, there's really, you don't have anything. You've got a dirty beard and you've got an old backpack, but I didn't have a job. I didn't have any money. And so I needed to come up with a plan, but I knew for sure that I was going to try to do the sail around the world. It had sort of been sitting in the back of my mind for a long time, but I never thought there would ever be an opportunity. And, you know, just, I didn't think it was actually ever going to happen, but you know, the solitude of being on the trail gave me quite a bit of confidence. So I sort of knew, okay, I can deal with isolation. That's not too big a deal. And really, though, it was the fact that I felt this huge amount of accomplishment and sort of this purpose. And just, I felt absolutely amazing that I had taken this, you know, 4.5 months and I had used them wisely. I mean, I really felt like I had done and made the right decision to go and do that trail. And, you know, even when it's over and all you have is memories, you know, that's all you get anyway. So it was like, all right, let's move on to the next. Let's make the next one even bigger.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. So much good stuff in there. So great to hear that it was such a positive experience. I know that it can be a huge mental...
Oh, it can be brutal.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it can be so brutal, but to just really be enjoying it. I definitely feel like that when I'm on a bike tour. Like, there's these hard days, but when everything clicks for like the afternoon, and you got that afternoon light, and you get to cook dinner at camp before it's pitch black, and just... It's just, I don't know, there's nothing better than that to me when it all clicks, and it's totally worth those moments that you get every once in a while to go through everything else. So you get done with the AT, you got this idea, you know, the AT has books written on it, obviously, because you read one, but there's so much guidance when it comes to doing something like that, because even though it is niche, it is still fairly popular. But with this thing, man, I've read tons of places that... like 4 or 5 people have done this, what you did in the size boat that you've done it. Was that the original plan, was to do something just totally really unknown for the most part?
You know, I didn't really think of it too much, as that, you know, I mean, I wasn't trying to do any records or anything of that sort. It was really just, I wanted to live that sort of adventure, and I wanted to be able to be like, yes, I sailed all the way around the world. The size of the boat really just came down to, you know, my budget, because like I said, I had a little bit of money saved, but I wanted to get it done within, you know, the next 5 years from finishing the trail. And so, you know, I knew I could work for 3 years, but I'd need a year to get the boat and prep it and get everything ready. And then on that fifth year, I'd take off. And so that was sort of the timeline that I had set up. And the boat that I bought, the Westsail 32, you know, this is an old American-made boat. It was built in 1975. And there's enough of them around that they're not very expensive. So I was able to pick this one up in that budget and then also be able to, you know, live for a year while I sorted it all out, pay for all the food and supplies and everything, and then basically load the boat and go for it. Obviously, I wasn't spending any money once I was out on the ocean, which was good, but I didn't have much either. I pretty much broke the bank when I did it, but, you know, I think it was money well spent for sure.
Well, if memories are your goal, man, you obviously made some. I can't even imagine. You know, I hate to admit this, but I being from Florida, growing up in the water, I've never sailed. And kind of crazy, you know, we lived inland, but still, I don't know anything about it, to be honest. Like, what kinds of things were you looking for leading up to this? Obviously the boat, but what kind of other things for such a long journey that that you would need, you know what I'm saying? Like, obviously, you know, things to pump water, food, the basics, but was there anything else? Like,
You know, not too much. I mean, that was through sort of these books that I read, you know, from the 1960s and stuff. The old time sailors, those guys really kept emphasizing simplicity. And so, you know, it makes a lot of sense. If you're going to be out in a place where you can't get repairs done, things like that, you know, you got to keep the boat as simple as humanly possible. You know, I set it up with very few electronics because electronics usually break down at sea, especially if you're out there for that long. And so, you know, I had the old school stuff. I had a sextant on board and I was using charts and things like that. You know, modern day, you can cross an ocean with an iPad without any problem at all. But wow, if that iPod decides to break, then all of a sudden you got to go back to the old. And that, again, was also born out of the budget. You know, I had to keep things, you know, the fancier stuff is really expensive. You know, you slap marine in front of any sort of technology and it doubles the price. So I basically wanted to, and it really does. I needed at least one really good brand new set of sails. The rest of them I bought used, but I have a sewing machine on board and stuff. You know, I don't want to get too much into the details because I could go on for an hour, but I did have some solar panels put on, and I had like a backup battery bank and stuff. And I had a computer which I could download weather, and I had the Garmin InReach so that I could, you know, send my daily post to my mom so that she knew that I was still floating and not missing at sea. But that was, you know, that was sort of the basics. And the rest of it really is just food and then spare parts here and there, whatever you think might break. If you can afford it, get a second one. And that's pretty much it. And then you basically set off and head out, because the actual route, it's not difficult sailing as far as, you know, navigating through it. I mean, it's open ocean sailing. So, you know, I didn't need to have a million different charts. I mean, I was primarily, I think I used 13 different charts on the whole trip. And, you know, it's one of those things where, again, you just want to keep it as simple as humanly possible.
You know, going from something like the AT, where to me it feels like, you know, okay, I might not leave with everything I need, or maybe I take too much and, you know, I'm going to be passing through towns and stuff like that. You know, I can kind of adjust my kit. For this, it almost feels like you don't want to have that feeling in the back of your mind when you take off, like, oh crap, I forgot my phone charger or something like that.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Is that how it is, or is there more forgiveness in kind of being able to go to ports and stuff than I realize?
The route that I was doing, no, there really isn't. I mean, when I set off from Gloucester, it was basically straight out to sea. And then the next time I was within, you know, 100 miles of civilization was south of New Zealand. So that's
no way.
Maybe 18,000 miles away. And I was only there for a little bit as I passed underneath it and then off to the Pacific. I mean, you know, the option of sailing to, you know, Australia or Cape Town, South Africa, it was there, but, you know, it wasn't, you know, I was almost 400 miles south of Cape Town when I passed underneath it. So it's not a quick hitchhike into town. It's, you know, more of a 4 or 5 day venture to get, you know, back to a place. 'Cause, you know, once you get away from the East Coast of the United States, there's really no more Coast Guard out there. So if you're in trouble, you better be able to deal with it. And, you know, that really is hugely pertinent when you get into the Southern Ocean, because there's literally nothing down there. And I think the 4 months that I spent, you know, basically below all of the continents, I only saw 4 boats, and 2 of them were fishing boats off of New Zealand.
Was that hard for you to deal with mentally?
I enjoy it. I mean, you know, it definitely gets a bit boring at times and such. But and you know, when the weather is spectacular and or there's, you know, beautiful stars, huge sunset, all that sort of stuff, that's when I always wish there was another person to, you know, just sit and chat with and show them how beautiful it is and that much. But I can sort of deal with the isolation as long as I know that eventually it's going to end. Then I'm happy to, you know, sort of bowl through it till the end. And it also, you know, it gives you time to sort of contemplate and also just be able to sort of really live in that moment and not miss a whole lot. You know, you take in so much when everything's, you know, quiet and there's no conversations. I mean, not that I didn't talk to myself quite a bit, but, you know, when you have another person there, it's easy to sort of miss out on a few things that are going on around you.
I mean, I can't imagine how many incredible sunsets and sunrises you saw and night skies. I mean, you're in probably the darkest corners of the planet. Probably looked unreal at times.
Oh, there was one in particular. So, you know, you go to the North Atlantic, you go to the equator, South Atlantic, and you go to the Indian Ocean. And I was about in the middle of the Indian Ocean when Tropical Cyclone Irving came sweeping down from the north. And I was able to just cut in front of it and sort of clipped me. It got a little hairy for one night. But the interesting thing was for the next 2 days, it was sort of like as that cyclone kept going south, it took with it every bit of moisture out of the air. And it was coinciding perfectly with the new moon. So it was pitch black. And I remember coming up on deck and the whole boat was lit up just like it would with maybe a half moon or more. And I was sort of looking around thinking, what's going on here? And then I realized it's just the stars were twice as bright as I'd ever seen them in my life. And, you know, it was like, all right, down below, make a huge pot of coffee. I'm going to be up for a while. And they're all sort of, you know, different stars, too. You still had a few of the normal constellations to the north, but the rest of it's all, you know, the Southern Cross and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, it was pretty miraculous. I'll never forget that. I can picture it right now exactly how lit up it was. It was really amazing.
That's so amazing. I mean, you're right. Make a pot of coffee, stay up. It's a sight to behold. I posted a picture not long ago of like a long exposure shot and someone commented on it and said, you know, I live in like downtown Boston. I haven't seen the stars in months. And I think like, how could you just do that? You know what I'm saying? Like, especially after having the experience of seeing, I just couldn't go that long without seeing the stars. And, you know, I'm sure such a small amount of people have ever seen it to the degree that you saw them. That's incredible. Wow.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a crime that, you know, all these people who live in these big cities never see them. I mean, they ought to at least take, you know, one day every year and, you know, shut all the lights off for about a half an hour and then turn them back on. That way at least people can get a glimpse. But,
yeah,
you know, I don't know what that would do to the power grid. Who knows? Maybe that's not a good idea.
Yeah.
Bit of a surge.
Yeah, for real. So you know, that this person actually was from Boston, and you left from Massachusetts as well, right?
Yeah, I left from Gloucester, Massachusetts. You know, I mean, it's obviously sort of a port of call for the Andrea Gale, which was the main focus of the Perfect Storm. And, you know, Gloucester has this really colorful history, and it's just, you know, for me, it's just the most amazing fishing port. You know, it's unbelievable, but it also has a bit of a history for solo sailing. So Alfred Johnson took off in 1876 on a 22-foot wooden dory, and he sailed from Gloucester to Liverpool, England. And it took 66 days, and he was, I believe, the first person to ever cross an ocean solo ever. And so he was sort of the great-grandfather of just trying to go out there and do it. I don't even know how he made it. I couldn't imagine that voyage there. But, you know, two decades later, Joshua Slocum went, and his last port of call in the United States was Gloucester, Massachusetts. And then he set off and did his 3-year circumnavigation to become the first person to solo sail around the world. And so it's got a bit of history, and I, you know, kind of felt like I wanted to add to it a little bit. And we've had some family that lived out there. My grandparents had a house out there for a while. And so it's just kind of, I figured it was a perfect spot to take off. Plus it was really close to Rockland, Maine, where I was doing all the work on the boat, and it made it for an easy exit.
carrying on the tradition. And so I saw when you left, I saw this video of like you saying goodbye to everybody, and you seemed so calm. Was that how you spent your time? Did you feel pretty at ease with this whole experience, or are you kind of always on guard, always a little bit tense? How do you handle sailing around the world by yourself?
That one, that video, that's all just editing.
I cut out all the tears.
I was there for like 3 days. You know, just little problems kept coming up, and you know, there was an oil leak, and then there was a diesel leak, and I, you know, there were so many things happening. You know, the sails, something was wrong, and you know, to the point where I forgot my one thing that I really wanted to do was go to a doctor and get some, you know, like a broad spectrum antibiotic. And I forgot to do that. I was in such a rush. And, you know, cause in October, it was October 3rd, we're still in the hurricane season. And so one of the things that makes this trip unique from 90% of the other, you know, circumnavigations that have ever been done is leaving from the East Coast. You have to cut right across the hurricane path. And, you know, we had Hurricane Irma, Maria, and I left maybe a week after Hurricane Jose passed by. And, you know, even when I was out there, I was still sort of ducking and dodging a little bit. So it was one of those things where, you know, I was wondering if I was actually going to do it. And then I took off, and you have to just sort of hope for the best, because, you know, the hurricane season is one thing, but then you have to get to Cape Horn, down at the tip of South America, you know, some 200 days later, but you want to do it as fast as you can, because as winter comes into the Southern Ocean, things get, you know, so dangerous, it's not even worth being down there.
And being so far from land, it must have been challenging to, first of all, why stay so far from the coast? Is there a reason for that? And also, it was probably hard to just tell where you were. I mean, it just all looks the same, of course, but just it didn't probably kind of like now, does it? People can't tell which day it is half the time. So it's all relative, you know?
It's true. Well, you know, out there, it's kind of funny because on the Appalachian Trail, I would lose what day it was of the week all the time. Never really cared. Didn't matter to me. You know, I didn't even like to wear a watch. But out there, you know, because you're navigating, you constantly are, you know, every 4 hours I was logging in my logbook and all that sort of stuff. And because I was, you know, doing a little bit of celestial navigation and stuff, so I was pretty on point on what day it was and everything like that. But you know, part of the reason that you are so far offshore is it just makes the route faster, because you really want to do everything as sort of straight line, so to speak, as possible. And the other thing, the closer you are to land, the closer you are to danger. There's more traffic, all that sort of stuff. Fishing fleets, you know, most of the fishing fleets operate on the continental shelf. And once you get past that, you know, you'll see some huge container ships and oil tankers and stuff, but those stick to pretty direct routes between, you know, the Mediterranean and New York and the Panama Canal and West Africa and stuff. So, you know, you can go, like I said, I went months without seeing a single.
That is wild, man. And so, you know, the whole effort was to do this nonstop.
Yeah. My goals were basically, I wanted to leave from the United States. I wanted to do it on an American boat. And I didn't want to anchor, tie off, stop in any way. I wanted to do it without any sponsorship, and I wanted to do it unassisted. And I succeeded in all those except for one. And we can get into that as it sort of comes up. But those were my goals for this sort of adventure.
Yeah. So being a, you know, I'd love to know which one it was, and hopefully I naturally bring it up. That's a nice little challenge for me as an interviewer. So no,
find the nugget.
Yeah, find the nugget for real. You know being a small boat, you know, and I know that was budget, but I imagine like storage is limited too. What was it hard to store literally 271 days worth of everything you needed on that boat, or did you find that to be pretty well? And how did that planning go? Were you able to kind of plan it well and hit your targets with food and everything?
I did pretty well Well, as far as fitting everything I needed on board, and I actually, you know, ended up having more available space than I thought. And that would really come into play once I was about south of Australia, when I started taking food inventories and realizing that I had not brought enough food by any shadow of a doubt. And I, you know, I thought, okay, I could probably make it in the beginning. And then, you know, another, you know, few weeks would go by, I'd do another inventory, and I'd be like, okay, this is going to get a little tight. So I started rationing, you know, food basically from about day, you know, maybe day 150, I started to ration things down, and all the way across the Pacific rationing. And it just sort of became more and more severe as I went. And actually, you've already found the nugget, because I ended up having to, way to go, Mason, not bad. I ended up having to sail to a bay outside of the Falkland Islands and have a food drop brought out. So a boat came out and they hucked a bunch of boxes full of food over to me, and I was able to continue on from there. But they were really cool about it. They didn't, you know, normally if you're going to go and buy things from a country, you got to check in, go through customs, do all that stuff. And my dad had sort of explained what was going on, and they said, no problem. Just if he can get here, then we'll toss the food over. He's just got to pay for it. And so I didn't even have to anchor or anything. The whole thing took like 36 hours of sailing along the coast to try and get into this little bay. And it took about 45 seconds for them to throw the food over. And then that was it. I was already leaving. So
holy crap. Hopefully it floated.
Oh no, they pulled right up next to me.
Oh.
And it was just like a chunk, because the weather is really bad down there. You know, I was wearing, I had my ski goggles on because the hail storms were just kind of coming through. And you know, it was doubtful whether or not I was even going to make it in there or if those guys were going to come out, but everything sort of worked like clockwork. And it really had to, because I, in my sort of frail state of mind, I was making some pretty poor choices, you know. Oh, wow. for about 3 or 4 days sailing towards the Falklands. I'm thinking, all right, I'm getting all this food, this is going to be great. And so I ate the last bits of anything I had on board. And when I actually was at the Falklands, I think I only had like 2 bags of rice. And there was, besides me coming to the Falklands, there was a pretty massive storm system as well. And had I arrived there, you know, who knows, 12 or 24 hours later, I may have been blown away from the island, and it could have been a while to get back. So, you know, hindsight is 20/20, but don't count on anything until you've actually got it in your hand. I'll tell you that for a little advice.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. Oh, I like that. That's a good quote. I actually write down a lot of quotes from interviews and keep them on my kind of my wall. So I'm going to write that one down. That's very good. I mean, this might be a stupid question, but is there the ability to fish while you're sailing, or is that just not?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I was fishing in the North and South Atlantic most times, you know, more in the tropics and stuff, and the mid-ocean. But once I got to the Southern Ocean, I found, you know, outside of being near land like New Zealand and going over their sort of shelves and stuff, I wasn't catching anything. And there were, you know, literally days the lures were out and I would change them up. Plus, the albatross and the other seabirds, they're big, and if they get your lure, their beaks can just destroy them. And so, you know, after enough time went, I was just, you know, there was just nothing I was going to catch. And I initially, that was the plan. It was like, all right, if I can just make it to the Atlantic, then I can just start catching fish. But it's just, that's a pipe dream. I mean, unless you're prepared to sit and float, and, you know, for days, you know, that's usually the only time where you're actually going to attract the fish, because anything that's just floating in the sea it doesn't take long before things start to come and investigate. You know, the bottom of the boat was covered with barnacles and all that sort of stuff. So the fish will come in, but, you know, I got to keep moving. And so, you know, it was just one of those things where, again, I just couldn't count on it. So I had to pull the trigger, and, you know, it was reluctant, but of all the goals that I had, that was the one that I was totally prepared to just, okay, that's fine. I'll take a little assistance. I need it. So that was okay.
Yeah, definitely. And that's actually a really cool story and sounds like a logistical nightmare. So I'm sure you're able to communicate pretty well on the boat because coordinating that with another boat in another country and what you needed, and hopefully it was good food too. So it's, dang, a lot going on there. So that's impressive to me to figure all that out. So,
oh, it was the greatest ham sandwich I've ever had in my life. You know, you could, I will never, like, I could go to the fanciest restaurant in the planet and order the most expensive ham sandwich and it'll never taste as good as that one.
Oh, absolutely not. Never. Yeah, that's good eating right there, man. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
So speaking of that, you know, I also heard that you had to rely on rainwater for a while. Is that true? And if so, what did you have to do? What was that like?
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of interesting. You know, I've been talking to a few people about this whole situation. So initially, I was planning on not taking a water maker with me. And I had the capability to hold 100 gallons of fresh water. And, you know, a lot of these guys that did this back in the 60s before, you know, reverse osmosis, you know, desalinators, that's what they would do. They'd load a whole bunch of water and it became the precious, you know, precious cargo. And one of my friends smartly talked me out of that. And he said, listen, just take one of these emergency pump ones. They make like a gallon of fresh water an hour. You just got to pump it yourself. And so I took one and, you know, I left. I had my 100 gallons. Soon after getting into the Indian Ocean, maybe like 400 or 500 miles past Africa, I started to run pretty low on my fresh water supply. You know, when I was trying to catch rainwater before, and I got lucky a few times here and there, but, you know, when you're trying to do that on a sailboat, there's a few different techniques, but you really need the rain to, you know, it has to last long enough to wash the salt off the sails and then keep raining. And it also can't be so windy and wavy that salt water is getting splashed into it. So it takes kind of like the perfect conditions to be able to collect it. And so I had been a little bit irresponsible with how much I was using, and I wasn't being super hardcore in collecting it. And it was because I had this water maker, and I pull the water maker out eventually because, you know, stocks are getting low, and it only produced maybe 20 gallons before it exploded. And, you know, oh, no. It was something where, like, I could still hear the crack of the thing. I tried to fix it a bunch of times. And, you know, the problem is there's a lot of pressure that's involved with desalinating water. And I never could get past that. And so, you know, from that point on, with, you know, about 20 gallons of fresh water left on the boat, I had to collect rainwater the rest of the trip. And the interesting thing that I've sort of been slowly figuring out is I don't think I would have ever gotten into that situation or gotten that low with fresh water if I wouldn't have brought that water pump. Does that make sense?
There's got to be a psychological term or phenomenon for that, because it's you see that in a lot of ways. Like when people know something's recyclable, they'll use a lot more of it. So it kind of, you know, is a wash when it comes to like the environmental purpose of the recycling. Or if people drive an electric car, they'll just drive a lot more. And so it really, you know what I mean? There's no benefit. So it's almost like when you know you've got this safety net, you just kind of get lazy with other things. I totally get that.
Right. Yeah, almost like it was like this false sense of security that I had. And again, I'm not blaming the water maker, because it was my fault. I was the one who was making the choices leading up to that. But yeah, it's sort of one of those things where when I look back on it, you know, if I didn't have that, I would have treated every drop of that fresh water up until that point very differently. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, I would never go out, you know, on another big long trip like that without a water pump, but I wouldn't count on it the way I had on this last trip. But, you know, it wasn't all bad because, you know, once I had to collect every last drop I could get, you know, it changed what a rainy day was to me. You know, normally on a sailboat, you're out there at sea, it starts raining and you're sort of like, you got to always wear your foul weather gear. It gets damp, it gets all this, and it's, you know, you're usually trying to hide from the rain. Not me. When it was raining, I was up there dancing around, trying to collect every little last thing and just loving it. Like I you know, if I saw a squall or a rain cloud coming, I was changing the course and heading right for it and getting ready. And, you know, it got pretty sketchy. I think the lowest I ever had on there was just a little more than 2 gallons of fresh water. But, you know, slowly but surely I was able to keep that stock going. And, but it wasn't until I reached the equator headed north that I finally filled the tanks in this massive rain squall that went on for hours. And I totally topped everything back up. But, you know, for a good 100, 150 days, it was basically, you know, okay, I think I have a week's worth left now. I hope I get some more rain and sort of just living, you know, day to day on it.
Good 100, 150 days. Jeez, I thought you were going to say miles. You said days. I'm like,
oh, no.
6 months nearly. I mean, like, what are you, 3, 4, 5 months? Are you kidding me? That's crazy to just be literally be surrounded by water and not be able to drink any of it.
Yeah, not even. And I, you know, I was sort of messing around a little bit with, you know, putting salt water in the kettle and trying to, you know, use the steam and evaporate that. But boy, when the boat's moving around and pitching and all that sort of stuff, it's pretty difficult at best. But I think probably one of the low points was I have two sort of 35-gallon tanks that are in the bilge. So they're in the very bottom of the boat. You lift up these floor hatches and one tank had, you know, maybe 10 gallons in it, but the other one was low enough where, you know, the little hose couldn't suck it up to the sink anymore. And I remember having a length of little plastic hose and I sort of stuck it in there like a big straw and I was just slurping it out. And that's, you know, that's got the crud in the bottom of the tank and everything. It didn't taste very good, but I was like, you know, I have to use every last little bit that I have.
What an adventure. So many things you don't even really think about either, you know? So you'd obviously, that's such a cool concept too. You mentioned like now looking forward to the rainy days. That's almost, it feels like a life lesson in there somewhere. Like, you know, used to hate these hard times or these rainy days or these, you know, off days, but now I was excited about them. That sounds, I don't know. That sounds like a lesson. I don't know how to do that in my life today, but find ways to make the rainy days useful.
If I could figure out a way to do that with all the other problems that, you know, normally come up in life, I'd probably be a millionaire.
Absolutely, man. Well, you, I'm sure there's a lot of millionaires listening to this wishing they were you. So, so was there anything you missed about kind of normal life? Maybe you forgot to bring it that you were really looking forward to. I know you had, you know, a lot of things, of course, food and coffee and we all, obviously you had a greater appreciation for water, but anything you wish you would have brought or guilty pleasure that you were really looking forward to?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously constantly fantasizing about seeing girls again and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, you know, it was sort of interesting how, you know, first thing that runs out is, you know, like fresh food, like bacon and eggs. And then you start to miss those. And then the chocolate runs out and then you start to miss that. And so, you know, slowly on this trip and again, through totally my own fault of the lack of provisioning and stuff, I was sort of watching, you know, all these little treats slowly disappear from my life, you know, down to the point where and I use food for example a lot, but down to the point where it's, you know, rice for breakfast, rice for lunch and rice for dinner sort of thing. And yeah, I mean, that's when for me, it was it was a huge time of sort of thinking about not only, you know, my life, but thinking about the lives of, you know, other people in the world that have, you know, a different sort of upbringing than I did. You know, I was very fortunate. I got wonderful parents that worked really hard and always made sure that we had what we needed and everything. And, you know, I'm out there now in the situation where, you know, there's no doctors around. There's not much food. There's no access to clean water. And, you know, it's sort of the situation where I'm like, you know, actually, this is how the majority of the people on this planet actually grow up and live almost their entire lives. And so it was sort of a big eye opener for me, because I had never, you know, really experienced something like true hunger. I mean, on the AT, you know, an AT through hiker is never satisfied, but that's through your endurance. I mean, you know, you're still eating all the time, but out there, you know, it was pretty ridiculous to literally hear your stomach gurgle, you know, while you're eating rice. You're sort of like, wow, holy cow. And so, you know, I don't know if I sort of went into a bit of a wormhole there, but, you know, it was a huge eye opener. And so you start realizing, wow, I had it so good, so good. Took it all for granted, you know?
Oh, what a great lesson too, man. I will say that's one of the biggest things that sticks with me today is just being hungry out on trips and just how awful it is. And definitely have a lot more compassion and understanding for that now. But obviously my wife gets on to me because I like, we'll go for a day hike and I'll bring like four sandwiches and a whole gallon of nuts. You know what I mean? I'm a little bit paranoid about it, but I totally, breaks my heart too, to see people hungry. And so that's interesting, man. It's great that you use it to kind of reflect on really how, like you said, a lot of the world lives. You know, we talked about kind of the isolation and staying away from land and just some of the challenges. What was it like finishing? What was it like getting to the finish line? Did you finish in the same spot you started?
Yeah. So I sailed back into Gloucester, and, you know, it's sort of the common joke between circumnavigators that do this is sort of like, yeah, I set sail and I sailed, you know, 30,000 miles, but I ended up right in the same exact spot. I never saw anything. And it's true. I don't know. There's just, you have to go right back to where you started. So, but yeah, it was pretty amazing. I got within, you know, maybe 20 miles or so of Gloucester, and the sun started setting and the wind completely dropped off. And I ended up floating, you know, for one extra night while I was out there, and just totally becalmed, no sails up. I'm watching all the jets around, I think it's Logan Airport, and I could see lobster boats and my cell phone works and all that stuff. And I think throughout the night I drifted within about 8 miles or 5 miles of the harbor. And yeah, the next morning, you know, a little bit of wind picked up. And basically one of the issues we had is that the day that I ended up in Gloucester was a really busy day. They have, you know, all these different summer events there. It was, I think it was June 30th. So you might add the Greasy Pole and the Blessing of the Fleet. Long story short, the harbor master was not really all that happy or excited about some loony who had been out on the ocean for 9 months coming in. And so basically he said, you know, we can use the harbor master dock between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. If I can't make it in there by then, you know, got to just go anchor somewhere else. And so my Uncle Bill, my dad, all this stuff, they all came out and they brought some fuel because I had run out of fuel, you know, months before. And I ended up sort of motor sailing the last like 5 miles in. So that we could get in there, but it was great. I mean, you know, as soon as I passed the break wall, there's cannons going off, and the Coast Guard had one of their boats there with a big, like 60-foot, you know, water cannon on the front and
celebrating
and,
you.
You know, yeah. Awesome. I mean, it's a pretty big deal as far as, you know, the sailing community. You know, I mean, Gloucester is mostly a fishing community, obviously, but, you know, had I chosen to, you know, leave from Annapolis or Newport, Rhode Island or something like that, it would have probably been, you know, lots and lots of boats out there, but you know, I had my ties to Gloucester, and so there were probably, you know, a dozen boats. And there was actually one guy who had rowed this one little tiny wooden boat out all the way to the breakwall. I don't know, maybe a mile or two. And I tipped my hat to him because he was the only one who wasn't on a powerboat. And he said he actually teared up when I did that. I got to talk to him afterwards. Wow. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. So cool. But nobody hopped on board. I thought, you know, everybody's going to come on board because it's another couple miles to get to the Harbor Master's dock. And I think everybody figured it was probably a pretty bad scene down below. But it was actually, I'd spent hours cleaning because I knew people were going to go on the boat. Mm-hmm. But so we motored all the way in, and then I just had to dock the boat, which I was pretty nervous about because I hadn't had any practice for a long time. Plus, there were like 50 people on the dock. And, you know, I get in there and it's just hugs all around and shaky legs and all that. But it was amazing. And, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where it's impossible to describe exactly how it feels because, you know, you're finally reunited with all these people you've been thinking about for so long and all that. And you also have that feeling again of accomplishing this goal that you set out to do and all that. But there's also, you know, there's that tiny thing in the back of your head that's sort of saying, well, okay, what's next? Or what am I going to do now? You know, there's always that. It's always back there. But it was one of the most amazing days I'm sure I'll ever have in my life.
I mean, it sounds like the ending of a movie. And I didn't mean, I totally would not be surprised to be a huge sort of event around you entering. I just didn't know if it was just your dad and your uncle there and you did kind of kept it quiet or there was going to be this celebration. I know a lot of times for adventurers, it can be pretty anticlimactic to get to where you're going.
Yeah.
Because no one cares. You know what I mean? Like, oh, you just biked across country or you just sailed around the world. No one knows that. And so it's that's awesome that you got to celebrate in such a big way. And yeah, that sounds like one of the greatest days you could possibly have.
When you finished your epic bike from Alaska down to Florida, how many were there a pretty big group of people? I mean, I know the story about, you know, some other bikers started joining you and stuff, but
yep,
it was pretty big.
It was funny because, you know, it was in Central Florida, busy Orlando, and like, you know, there's all these people and there's cars and people going to Disney World and street traffic and, you know, or traffic lights. You just got to still be on your game. And we finally get into the neighborhood. And yeah, my family's there. My buddy's family's there, some friends. And we had a big barbecue. But yeah, I'd say 20, 30 people, but all family. And
nice.
But, you know, it was in a little tiny cul-de-sac. So people were like, what the heck is going on here? And so we had to go around and explain
right,
to
right.
The neighbors, like, oh, they're biking here. But yeah, nothing crazy. Cause you know, a couple months, 2 to 3 months is so different than almost literally, you know, what are you, 9, 10 months you were gone?
9 months. So I think almost 9 months. Exactly. Yeah.
Holy cow, man.
Well, and I think when Sail Magazine did a short little piece on it, I think the title of it was like Michigan Man Circumnavigates on the Quiet. And I think a lot of that is just because I wasn't seeking out any sponsorship. So, you know, when you take on sponsors and all that stuff, obviously the name of the game is to get the word out, to draw the attention and stuff. And I, you know, to be honest, I had such low odds of actually being successful in this journey. I mean, almost anybody would, you know, that I wasn't like, I'm going to go do this and yeah, and all that stuff. And, you know, looking back now that I, you know, that I made it, I probably should have, but, you know, hindsight again, 2020.
Oh man, I'm, you know, great, you know, sponsorships and stuff is great. And we have a lot of people obviously on the show that have to do that or choose that route. And that's wonderful because there's a lot of great companies that want to sponsor and they're excited to be involved, knowing they might not ever get the chance to people that work there, but they love supporting adventures like this. But the fact that you did it without any of that is pretty damn impressive, if you ask me, man. That's awesome. You save the money, you put in the time, you chose a boat that a lot of people wouldn't, and like you said, you freaking made it happen, and that is definitely worth celebrating. And so you mentioned a few times, you know, it's in the back of your mind, what's next? You know, what has the last few years been like, just reeling from this experience? Because I'm sure it felt like a decade out there. You know how it is when you're out there and every day is just so different than what normal life was before. You know, how has it been at readjusting? And also, what is kind of rolling around in your head now? And obviously, you can talk about your book, too. We'd love to share that.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, physically, you know, it probably took me 2 weeks to get sort of my land legs back. I was bumping into things left, right, and center. And, but, you know, mentally, it was a little bit odd. You know, I got a bit overwhelmed by sort of bigger crowds of people. I definitely loved being, you know, in a small group and stuff, but I started doing a few presentations, you know, pretty quickly, I think within about 2 weeks of returning. And I sort of found that I had a pretty good knack from, you know, I think my past jobs and stuff where I have to do a lot of sort of presenting awards and things like that. But I think the story really told itself, and all the connections and stuff that I had made through the bitter end and stuff all really helped to line up a bunch of them. And so I was able to do quite a few presentations, and that was so fun, because it's, you know, you get that same sort of adrenaline boost when you're up on stage. But, you know, that was definitely mixed in with a lot of the post-adventure depression, like really, really bad. And it was really interesting because I was listening to the podcast. I don't know which one it was, but you guys were talking about that. And that's the first time I've ever heard anybody else talk about it. And I was thinking to myself, holy cow, all right, it wasn't just me. And, you know.
Yeah, that was actually with the AT hiker.
Yeah. He was on the trail in 2012, I think. And I didn't recognize his trail name. My trail name was Geronimo, but you know, you never know. Sometimes your best friend could be walking one day behind you for the entire trip. But,
exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I was pretty down. You know, it was either I was super duper excited about, you know, presenting, I was on the road headed to this place or that place, and then I would just crash and be like, oh my gosh, what is this place? You know, I'd walk into a grocery store and stare, and you know, I call that the Hurt Locker moment, because there's that scene where he's like back from, you know, being at war.
Oh, yeah,
and all
right
that
at the end,
staring, and I, you know, I'm looking at all this food and people are buzzing around me and they got all their cell phones and I'm just sort of there, big scraggly beard, you know, and I'm just thinking to myself, what happened to my world? And so that, you know, I've slowly been able to come to grips, and you know, the longer you get back into society, the more normal it becomes and everything. But you know, it was one of those things where I sort of lost my purpose in a lot of ways, but you know, it's been pretty cool for probably the last year or so. You know, I was able to sail back down to the Caribbean, and that was where I was able to write the book. I had some great advice given to me from another author, a guy, John U. Bacon, who wrote the Great Halifax Explosion, amongst other, you know, bestsellers and such. And so I went down there and buckled down and, you know, cranked out 4 hours every single day. And after enough months went by, I had the book, and, you know, I tried to get it published through a company and all that. And that was pretty tough, because it's a bit of a niche audience right there with the whole sailing thing. And, but eventually I was just like, yeah, I'm just going to put it out through Amazon, you know? And so it's as an ebook, and then, you know, eventually I'm sure I'll do an audio book, but, yeah, it's been great. You know, I get, you know, emails and stuff, and people talk about how they love reading it. And I've actually been able to walk onto more than one boat and they've actually already got it. And I couldn't, that was one of the coolest things in the world.
That's really cool.
Was one of my goals. Yeah. To walk in and see it, you know, on a shelf with some of those other books that I used to read that inspired me to do it. And, you know, I actually was signing a book today, so I don't care if I sell another one, but I've already, you know, I've gotten to do that. So it was all well worth it.
Man, it's going to continue to influence people. And, you know, sometimes it just feels like that post-adventure depression is, it's almost like a rite of passage, almost like you have to go through that too. It's really bizarre, but the more I talk about it and the more I hear others, it just seems like it starts coming out from everybody I've ever known that adventures. It's like, oh yeah, I dealt with that too. And it's so relatable too. And so, you know, a lot of folks will just then write a book to help process that. And I don't know, I definitely feel that too, but man, that's so cool to hear that you're on the shelves of those folks influencing, you know, God knows how many youngsters all around the world that find that book somewhere, start reading it, and like, holy cow, this is amazing. It'll continue to live on for years and years to come. You know, it's going to be on. People are going to come across it and buy it, of course. So that's really exciting. But wow, Jerome, you mentioned an audiobook, man. You got a great voice, great storyteller. You obviously went through it all, so telling it from your voice would be pretty incredible too.
Yeah. I think if I can slice some time out and get the proper equipment to do it, then I'll be able to reread it and everything. So, you know, hopefully get there, but who knows? I'm on the verge of maybe coming up with the next adventure, but with the world going through what it's going through right now, things are a little up in the air, to say the least. So we'll just have to see how things play out.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a before and after world with this being a very big pivotal moment. So it's a lot of change happening all over the place. But Jerome, man, I'd please keep us updated if you do something else. Tell us. We'd love to have you on. This was awesome. I appreciate you being on, man. I'll let you know when it comes out. And yeah, thank you so much for setting this up.
Hey, my pleasure. And we got to get you over that fear of the water. Thank you so much, Mason. I really appreciate it. I know you got your busy, so we'll keep in touch, my friend.
All right, man. We'll talk soon. See ya.
Yep.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.